clear that there are different kinds of civilizations we're dealing with, namely four different kinds. We said at the time that there are four kinds. Why should there be four? I had something about that here. See, we're waiting for him. Ah, there goes the bell. Now we can start. Why just four types? Throughout the world, down at Lincoln Beach, all over South America, North America, Europe, Asia, Africa, you'll find glyphs. You'll find petroglyphs, and the commonest of all petroglyphs is this. That's the quadrata. What does it stand for? What do you think this stands for? What? It's a quadrata. It's the sign of the cosmos, you see. How do you think the most primitive people would be aware of the fact that it should be divided into four, no less than four parts? Most people are aware of being on the earth because they look at the sky. And what do you learn from the sky? What in what direction does the sun rise? As Luther says in his immortal hymn, well, as Saint Saxe has an immortal hymn. Sun rises in the east, solis occideret redire possunt, as the poet says. The sun goes down in the west and it comes up again in the east. Everybody notices that, you know. But today you'll notice an interesting thing. This week we have the equinox. The ancients observed very closely the rising and setting of the sun. We know that all over the world you find, especially in Northern Europe and so forth, you find the megalithics, the stone circles and so forth. The Old Testament is full of them. Remember, Jacob sets up his stone. The circle of 12 stones is very important. The covenant between between Laban and Isaac is made between Laban and Jacob, his uncle Jacob, was made at the ring of the 12 stones at dawn, just as the sun came up. Yes, they marked this rising and setting of the sun very closely because it concerned them very much. But if you notice, there's where the sun rose this morning, but tomorrow it'll rise up there, and then it'll go there. Farther and farther, farther north, you get the other direction. Of course, the fixed north star that doesn't move. And then all of a sudden, at the solstice, it changes its direction, starts back. And this week, it gets right in the middle. It's halfway between all the way south it goes and all the way north. Then when you get up in the north, it becomes very marked and very important to notice because it means a great deal. So the earth is divided into four parts. Well, what goes along with these four parts, with these four directions? What about the winds, the four winds? Are there just four winds? No, but we gauge them as four winds because that's the way we can locate them on the pattern. On this pattern, we can locate them. It's a north wind, a south wind, east wind, and then there's a north by north, there's a northeast wind, and then there's a north by northwest wind, and so forth. And you divide the windrows up in on the quadrate pattern. Everything is in four. But along with that, we have the four seasons, don't we? They're very important, they're basic. And what about human nature? Now, you all know about that. How many humors do we have, Brother Irwin? Brother Irwin here? Start calling the wrong minute. How many humors? That's one way of calling it. We'll start at the beginning. How many humors do we have, Sister Alburn? How many humors? A humor is the types of human beings, you see, that the alchemists and others. Sister Alburn here? Yeah, how many humors are there? The four humors, yes. And what are... But inside, and what are they? Does anybody know what they are? The choleric, that's bile, the melancholic, black bile. There's the phlegmatic, the sluggish, phlegmatic, and the sanguine, the bloody, those are the four tempers. The sanguine is the eager beaver. The phlegmatic is the very opposite. The choleric is the short-tempered person, hard to get along with person. The melancholic person is the sad and brooding person. Jan Cassius has the lean and hungry type and so forth. These four types. But you notice, the thing about it is, nobody is completely, everybody has, dominates one type or the other, see? We still say that, you see? They're type A and there's type B, you see? Type A, gets like me, gets heart attacks, and type B don't, and things like that. But we divide into types. We always have. It's been done since ancient times. But this is pretty good. This is the way the ancients divided it up in. And the... these four types, but we're all mixtures of all four, you see. There's some of it all in you, as far as that goes. So, but one type will dominate in your particular case. Well, along with the four types, and far more elementary than that, I should have got before I talked about the four types, about the elements. How many elements are there? Four. And what are the four elements supposed to be? Earth, air, water, and fire, doing in their... form and their degrees of coarseness. And this is very ancient too. The earth is the heaviest, the water is the next, The air is the next, and the fire is the lightest of all. So you go up and up and up. But there's mixtures, and of course, the whole of the surgery, of medieval surgery based on Galen, was that everybody is mixtures of these tempers. And when one of these gets out of hand, when you get too much of one temper or one element, then you're sick, and you have to cure them and bring them to a balance again. So we have the four elements of which everything are composed. And what are the four qualities of these elements? Wet, dry, hot, and cold. See, everything falls into four, so it's natural that we should have four types of society. And actually, it would seem that there are these four types as far as that goes. They still talk about them and the like. They thought they were brand new discoveries recently when people like Ruthie Benedict at Columbia wrote a sensational book which he entitled Patterns of Culture. And he's right, well, it wasn't Vaihinger, but Knigge. A sensational book in the early 19th century. Kerpebound character. The physical build and character, the four physical builds. There's the picnic type, the nice fat type. There's the athletic type, the balanced type. There's the kinesthetic type, the long thin type. And so it goes, the four types of being. And this was taken as real science all through the 19th century. It's not Hans Vaihinger, it's related to him. Geschlecht and character, well. I will say I'll think of it in a minute, but of course I don't have time to think of it in a minute. So we go on then. And they're always mixed. Now the Book of Mormon gives us four societies, and they're sharply defined in the Book of Mormon, and they're always in conflict. They hate each other, but they're all mixed too. We have some of this in all of us, as Walt Whitman tells us. There are attractions to each type, and there are virtues in each type, attractive qualities, and there are weaknesses and vices in each type, and the excess of any of them is ruin. And we put the four types on. We have in the Book of Mormon here and everywhere else. First, I talked about the brotherhoods. That's a fancy name to give them. And this is unique. This is set apart. This is something strange. But this is the church. These are people of Israel. These are the chosen people. That there are on the earth an elect and special group, somebody that have information that is not known to others because others are not willing to share it. Others view it with hostility. And incidentally, I don't need to apologize anymore for speaking in a science building. I'm not a science because I'm quoted in the last Science Digest, that eminent journal. Really. And this is the brotherhoods. I call them the brotherhoods because that's what Santa Ana has, and that's what Newton calls them, and so forth. We call them the brotherhoods. See, we belong to such a society, and you see, it's not just that you're members of the church, but being Mormons is something different. See, that's it. There's something that people can't grasp there, that they can't come to terms with. We do our darndest to come to terms with the world. We do everything we can to be worldly. I mean, nothing could be more worldly, say, than a ZCMI catalog or something like that. I mean, that's not just worldly, that's Babylonian. But it won't do, you see, because... And there have always been these brotherhoods. You find them within tribes and everywhere else. Now, we talked about the Rechabites, see, the people that left out. They were a special group, and in Lehi's time, they were allowed... The only people who were trusted to serve in the temple, because during a time of troubles, only they stood up for Israel, and they went out in the desert when the city was so corrupt and lived by themselves and waited for more light and truth and so forth. In a family organization, this is exactly what the people do in the Dead Sea Scroll. Those people. And so we have these people here. Now, I have written two rather long articles. One is on called The Companions of the Cave. It was in the Revue de Qumran. I should write down the numbers and so forth. You're not going to have to read that, is it? Showing that there were such societies in the desert long before, and long after, actually, the Dead Sea Scrolls people. The other is called The Gospel of the 40 Days, the Evangelium Quadragenarium. That was in the Dutch publication called the Vigiliae Christiane. And that was when the Lord returned after the 40 days, remember? It tells us in the end of the Gospel, and Mark, that he came together with them, and they hadn't believed in the resurrection. And then, beginning with Moses and the prophets, he went through all the scriptures and explained all things to them, and then their eyes were open. But we're not given a word of the sermon he taught them. He taught them that sermon. Book of Mormon, it tells us the very same thing, remember? He asked for the scriptures to be brought, and he went, beginning with Moses, he went through everything and made sure that it was all there, filled out the blank, pulled out the book of Malachi, which had been written since they'd left Jerusalem, and he brought them up to date and turned the scriptures over to them. The same sort of thing. Now, these were people that had that knowledge that the Lord taught after the resurrection. For the last 50 years, if they found a very own, they've been finding for the first time, see, the Kenoboskian Library, the Coptic Library in Egypt, and the Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth, other collections found. But a Christian document's almost bound to begin, this is the secret teaching the Lord gave to the apostles after the resurrection. The people that had that secret teaching and kept it to themselves and kept themselves in close societies, they were the people that claimed that secret knowledge. They claimed it, they didn't have it. As a marvelous passage, the earliest church historian, Hegesippus, is quoted in Eusebius as saying, as long as there was a living apostle, these people couldn't emerge. But as soon as the last witness was dead, then they came out, crawled out of the woodwork, he says, everywhere. Everybody claiming he had the knowledge, the secret knowledge that Christ gave the apostles. He was the head of it. He was to be the head. He knew the knowledge, and that knowledge is called the gnosis, our word knowledge. And they were Gnostics. The Gnostics come under the brotherhoods. They formed that. But that doesn't have the... There are many of them. See, that's our word know, kno. We say gnostics, the gnostics. They're the people that know, that have the knowledge. They claim to have it. And which one of them did have it? Well, Epiphanius left some 88 different sects, each of them claiming to have it. And we have the writings of many of them. See, the Coptic Scrolls, the Kenoboskian Library, are full of it. And we have the whole library here, just as we have all the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, we don't have about 5% of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But this is a large library, and it's the same thing. But this is the kind of they formed these brotherhoods, and they were very secret and so forth, and they had prophecy, and they wore, sometimes they went extreme, they would go always around dressed in white, and they had strict rules of diet, and some of them strict rules of chastity, and follow the usual mystic society and so on. You can think a lot of those. They go back to the earliest times. The phyli of the Egyptian priests, right in the beginning, followed this pattern. They shaved their heads, they bathed frequently and so forth. They wore their white robes, they had their secret language, but they, in communicating with themselves, they, in their cosmic teachings and the like, their teachings were only known to themselves. See, that's why we've never been able to read the hieroglyphs since. Today, they're just beginning to find out that that's it. Hieroglyphs were meant for such people as that, and they don't say all that we think they say, especially some of the stories that we thought were little folk tales and so forth. But you have this sort of thing, and there is a very interesting writing, a tomb, a very complete writing by an Egyptian priest called Petosiris, who you think just might be quoting the Bible all the way through. In fact, he is quoting the Bible. There must be a collection with the Jews. But here, and then you have the seven wise men that go back to the beginning, the wisest men in the world, this so far. They travel around from place to place, taking wisdom and receiving wisdom. They go through the world, always wandering, viewing God and his works, and bringing solace, comfort, and healing to the human race. And they, again, go with nothing but a staff and a robe, so Jesus is confused. The statue of Peter in St. Peter's is a statue of a sophist, a pretended sophist. They were very common just after the time of Christ. So they went around bringing healing to the human race. But once a year, they would come together. Sometimes once a year, sometimes once 7 years, they would come together and compare notes and share their secret signs and symbols and all that sort of thing. And so we have the Hermetic societies, the Orphic mysteries, let's say with their gold. The best known of all these is the Pythagorean society. They gave us the Pythagorean theorem and a lot of other wisdom. Pythagoras was a great thinker of the time of Lehi, and they formed their communities in southern Italy and were persecuted out of existence because these people always excite suspicion and fear wherever they go, because they keep to themselves and they have these unusual powers, and they view the heavens, and to Pythagoras we owe a great deal of knowledge, you know. And then Plato followed his pattern with the Lyceum. We mentioned the Cathari, and they come down to the Middle Ages. But we're talking about the Book of Mormon now. But Lehi has such a community. Of course, they're out in the desert by themselves and the like. He breaks away from his... And Nephi, when they settle in the new country, before they're here long, Nephi and his people have to break away again because the others have become corrupt. And notice there was this constant friction. Here we have two different types of civilization, two different attitudes, laymen and laymen. They weren't just cools, Levi. They hated his guts, see. They planned to kill their father, see. We've led him out away from all these years we might have been living in Jerusalem enjoying things. That takes us to the second type of civilization we have in the Book of Mormon. But again, Mosiah leaves his people out, and then Ammon does, and then Alma especially leads them out by the waters of Mormon. You'd think there was another Qumran there. And there they take, they are baptized, and they take their vows, and they live in a very happy surrounding and farm, as they should, an idealistic community. But the gospel is their whole life. These people, and they're the brotherhood, see, call each other brothers and sisters, and so it goes. You have any others here? Well, later on in the 14th, in the 18th century, utopian societies everywhere. Well, beginning, of course, way back in the 17th century with the 1600, we have the four great utopias with Bacon's life. Yes?
Oh.
The great Edward Meyer, who is the greatest authority on ancient history, perhaps who ever lived, of course, he was fascinated by Joseph Smith. But it was Brigham Young who was responsible for the Deseret. He thought the Deseret alphabet was the greatest production of the 19th century, not just of the Mormon church. He says that was a mark of pure genius and inspiration, he said. Of course, we didn't use it. It was way over. It was a simple, practical, a good, but it set them apart from the world. It was the last step, you see, to have this Deseret alphabet. And it's an important thing. A little while ago, you could get Deseret alphabet books in any bookstore in Salt Lake, but you can't anymore. They've all been snapped up. I used to have quite a lot of them. I'd give them away for presents and so forth. I don't have any more. There were something now, collector's items and so on. No, that's true, the Deseret alphabet, this thing that distinctly set them apart. Not only, you see, the mark of these things, not only they were devout and religious people, holy men ye know not of, as the Doctrine and Covenant says, but they were very intellectual. Remember, this is Pythagoras, after all. They studied the cosmos, the cosmology and the like. They were the wise men. The wise men were sprung from them and so forth. And so we have utopian societies, which emphasized all these things. You know, the great utopias. In 1616, there was Thomas of Campanella's City of the Sun, and there was Francis Bacon's... what was that? Oh, that was 1525, wasn't it? Francis Bacon's Atlantis, New Atlantis. And then the classic one. No, the classic one was Thomas More's. That was 1525. Thomas More's Utopia. He gave it the name Utopia. And ever since, there have been utopian societies. In Joseph Smith's time, there were utopian societies all over the place, resembling the church very much in some things, so that in the 50th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, remember, the brethren were sent off on a mission to the Shakers. Now, the Shakers... It said that they have many good truths, but in many things they are mistaken. They wanted to live pure from the world, and they lived all together and shared at a common table and lived in common houses and so forth. Today, a very recent issue, June issue, I think, of the National Geographic has a long spiel on the Shakers. Their membership today is 12 members. They're all old ladies. There's two men and 10 old ladies, and that's what's left of them. Well, what happened? Well, they didn't marry, see, because they had these strict... rules of chastity. That's strict. But that didn't keep it from growing. There are plenty of people who wish to join it, not only retire to it, but saw no reason why they shouldn't live that way. It grew very rapidly and became very large. It reached its peak in 1840 and 45, and then it just dwindled away. And today they have this great property, and they have all their establishments and their houses. They're very well known. It tells us in this article that... Bill Crosby just paid $80,000 for a chair, just a simple wooden chair, because their handwork was so perfect, so beautiful, their dedication to perfection, you see. But it was materialistic too. They're concerned with these things. And then a candlestick sold for a candelabrum sold for $100,000. Well, that's how rare those things are. It's the rarity that gives them their value more than anything, because you see, this is the last that will ever be made. These old people now are the last of the Shakers. When they die, there won't be any more left. And there were many societies in Joseph Smith's day like that. There was the Amana Society. Well, they're still hanging on. And there were the Owenites. And there were all sorts of idealistic societies began out. The spiritualism began near Rochester, New York. It was first in a family in... It began in Maine. They moved to Rochester, and they hired all these spirit wrappings and table movings and so forth. And what's the man's name? He moved, and then it grew very rapidly. They sent missionaries to Europe, and especially Daniel Holm. He was sensational, the things he could do. And within 20 years, they had 10 million members. Then they increased to 14 million members. Today, there aren't any. Well, this is the way it goes, you see. Oh, you say spirits was scattered here and there. But Joseph Smith was different. It didn't go that way at all. It was not a fad. People have this idea, and we have this idealistic society, but it'll only work within the gospel. And so the work went on and so forth. And within so-called primitive society, you always find fratries and clans. And then what you find, remember, with Pachomius in the 4th century in Egypt. See, the Egyptian phylis, a priest had always lived this holy way. And so in the 4th century, when a rich young man in Alexandria, which was a completely Christian city, that was St. Anthony, he saw that the people were living very wickedly. They were not living the way the gospel said they should live. So he went out and he became the founder of monasticism, as you all know. St. Anthony went out in the desert and settled there, and this spread, and it went to Cluny in Italy in the 6th century, and then it goes up to England, and it flourishes in the 16th century, become the very rich Cistercians, and then the mendicant orders like the Franciscans, and then the Dominicans and so forth. These monastic orders are all attempts to follow their brotherhood. You see, they call each other brother, and they wear long robes, and they eat at common refectories, common tables, and they practice chastity, and they go around doing good, and they spend their time copying books or otherwise engaging mostly in prayer and so forth, but some of them are very intellectual. They'll say the Jesuits, the classic example of that. So the monastic, but the great monastic systems we think of are the Buddhist. Buddha was a contemporary of Lehi again. That started that going. And everywhere you find, today you find, whether it's in China or whether you find it in Tibet or in Japan, you find your Buddhist monasteries with the monks in their long robes. Some are lamest. You see the lamest, that's the old Bain religion, who under Lambana, who had the race, they compromised with the Buddhists. So you have the Buddhists and the Lamas, but these there have been millions, more Buddhists than anything else, to live in these monasteries and hit the bells everywhere, whether it's in Europe, whether it's Ireland, or anywhere, they ring their bells and they have their dinners and they spend their time reading their books and they copy their scriptures and they cultivate their gardens, you see, because it's their agriculture people. They support themselves either by that or by begging and so forth. They go throughout the world. And so we find the monastic orders everywhere, including the Christian monastic orders. Yes, excuse me.
Can we equate the word brotherhood almost with the desire to live law of consecration?
Yes, this is. It's supposed to be law of consecration. That's what it is. They consecrate everything they have. So you take the three laws of chastity, poverty, and obedience. You're not your own master. We take the vow of obedience, and we take the law of chastity, and the law of consecration, which they call the law of poverty. You don't have any more property than you need. You have enough to live on, and that's it. So they have consecration, too. They consecrate everything. Their time, their lives, and everything else is consecrated to the building up of the kingdom. So these are very close parallels, you might say. So we find these in the cases of Lehi, Nephi, Mosiah, and in Alma's case, it's described as such. So let's get to the second type of society then. Well, and that is what is always called the world. We always call it the world. The world. And we know what that is. I should have brought along. My New Testament. But you know, the Lord says. The expression, incidentally, "in the world but not of the world," is not found in the Bible at all. That we try to justify ourselves. We are being in the world but not of the world. Oh no! But the Epistle of John, he tells us, you cannot be in the world without being of the world. Come out of the world. We like to have both today, and that's one thing. As Brigham Young says, there's nothing in the world more painful, more hard, that will tear you apart, like trying to have it both ways at once. But in John 14 to 17, where the Lord is, his prayer in the garden and so forth, is, "I pray not for the world, but those who have come out of the world." He prays for the apostles. He names them, "They're all brothers, that they may be one with me as I am with you, Father." All this for three chapters, he goes on and on in the book of John, in which they are all together, you see. This is atonement. This is at one moment. "But not of the world. I've called them out of the world, and the world hateth them, because the world has hated me." There's hate between them, you see. And yes?
I remember a few years ago, maybe you can recall it, L. Tom Perry, he gave a talk on this scripture from the Bible.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Do you recall it?
I don't remember it, no.
Maybe it would be good to look up, because he does talk about living in the world and not...
Oh, I know. I know some people think you can do both, but you can't. Yeah. Oh, there's all sorts of rationalization. You want to live in the wilderness? No, that's what it is. That's what it is, I assure you. Yeah. This has bothered lots of brethren, I can tell you that. No, how are we going to come out of the world? Now, this is when we drop the enrollment, you see. We have no trouble in overcrowded rooms. But the truth is, you see, you cannot, as the Lord says in the Epistle of John, be in the world and of the world. What is the world, in other words? You've got to define it. It's beautifully described in the 18th chapter of Revelations, where it describes all the good things that are for sale, and including and the fast transportation, and the chariots, and the silks and the satins and the precious things, and the souls of men, it says. You can buy anything, you see. Well, you have anything in this world for money. That's what marks this world. No, the Lord says to the apostles, remember, I will not, right at the end of John, he says, I will not walk longer with you, because the prince of this world cometh, who has nothing in me, and Satan is the prince of this world. And when Satan tells Adam, I am the god of this world, he's right, you see. He's not the... Satan tells the truth about all sorts of things. Just as when he says you can have anything in this world for money, because he's fixed it that way. You can go into those things. Yes, we can. You can spend your days straightening nails, if you will. I don't think that's a profitable or a holy calling at all. Straightening nails just to be straightening them. Reminds you of Diogenes rolling his barrel on the next. See, everybody was so busy in Athens making money, and Diogenes just sat, as you know, lived in his barrel. That's all he needed. He sat in the sun enjoying himself, and wise men would come, including Alexander the Great, came all from all over the world to consult him. He was a great problem solver. But in the daytime, he would roll his barrel from one end of the street to the other, rolling my barrel up the other end of the street. What are you doing? Oh, he says, I'm busy, I'm rolling. You have to see, I have to be busy in this town, so I'm rolling my barrel on the next. Well, that's the story of a person who spent hours just straightening nails. You can't use them again. You know, after you straighten the nail, you can't use it. But he was told to straighten nails all day because that was a good activity. It was an activity of no point. Is life so short? Is life so long that we can afford that sort of nonsense? No, there... well, we won't go into that. But, no, this is true. Now, how is it defined here? Of course, it's given the name. The Bible refers specifically to the... by certain types or codes. What is the type of the world? It's Babylon or Rome, first section of the Doctrine and Covenants, whose idol is that of an image which waxeth old in Babylon and shall perish in Babylon, even Babylon the Great, which shall fall. This is Babylon and Rome, and of course what John is talking about is the Roman Empire. And what are these? What is the characteristic of this civilization? It's cosmopolitan, it's rich, proud, powerful, imperial, acquisitive, success-oriented, competitive, materialistic, also licentious, cruel, necessarily, ultra-respectable, sensual, and it seeks the four things that both Nephi's tell us about. Oh, that's an interesting thing. Maybe I have something here. Well, I have it right here. The four things. Here was a very recent statement. I cling to the Wall Street Journal, so no one can accuse me of being unorthodox. And this was a good one from the Wall Street Journal. And it says there are just four things. It had... Oh, I didn't bring it this time. How sad. Wait. Maybe here. Just a minute. Nope. I left it home in the bag. Well, bring it the next time. But it says those four things are power, gain, popularity, and the lust of the flesh, and the pleasure of the... That covers everything. That covers all we talk about on TV and all we are all after that. But how is it characterized in the Book of Mormon? Now, notice there's the contrast. There's a conflict between these two. How can you reconcile it? There is a great gulf between them. And what's the Book of Mormon talking about there? What is the great and spacious... Gave it away. What is the world in the Book of Mormon? The great and spacious building. And Nephi and his people... Lehi and his people are on the other side, and there was a great gulf between them. You do not mix between them. There wasn't a common ground between them where they held a marketplace and went out and met on the Maidan, set up their tents, and swapped back and forth. Though all these are interlaced, they're all, it's true we're in the world, and it's true there are good things at all these levels to be had, but it's like the four elements, it's a case of balance, isn't it? And so in the Book of Mormon, this is very, very conspicuous. There's no more striking image anywhere in literature than that of the great and spacious building, which is doomed to fall. And that's, the people are finely dressed, they're clever, they're smart, they're having a gay party. The place is brightly illuminated. They hold the people out down in the garden, the little poor bedraggled food-gathering bums back there. They point their fingers at them and laugh at them. There's anybody who'd go out for that sort of existence, they can't stand it. So, and of course, it was the world. He says the great and spacious building was the world, and it fell, great the fall. Like Rome and Babylon, it is doomed to destruction. As I said, the word destruction occurs over 400 times in the Book of Mormon. Destruction is the theme, that we should have such a downbeat, such a negative approach. But it's for our benefit. I mean, we're getting closer, yes?
Lehi's dream, does the iron rod span the gulf, or is it?
No, it doesn't. The iron rod leads to salvation. Those that lead fall, it doesn't span the gulf. There's a stream of filthy water going along by the side of it, and you let go of it, and you're into the stream. You'll never get to... They wanted to get to the other side, but you can't, unless you accept. But the iron rod doesn't lead to the great and spacious building where we want it to lead. It's interesting in the days of the temple. The temple rock has been changed a lot. It's been shaved down. It used to be a very steep, high hill in the Solomon's temple. And in bad weather, it was hard to get up to. And there was the sacred way that went up to it. And it's like the way up to Adam's. What was Adam's Rock in Ceylon? So you go up to Adam's Rock in Ceylon the same way. And to get up to it, there was a railing. And we're told that it used to be made of iron, but it rotted away, and it was replaced by a wooden railing or brass links. And with substitutes played it. With the ages, it rotted away. But to say they used to have, to get up to the temple, they used to have along for old people and the sick and so forth, to get up the slippery rock, if it was raining and so forth, you had to cling to a rod. And it was an iron rod. That may be where the idea came from. If you clung to the iron rod, it would get you to the temple. And but they said in time, of course, being iron, it rusted away. It's very ancient. That's one approach. But it is doomed. And like the great and abominable, it is the great and abominable, which we're told is whoever fights against Israel. It's not just one church. Whoever fights against it is the great and abominable, and that's the world. And it's a composite, we're told, in the 22nd chapter of Nephi, like the seed of Abraham itself. Nephi 2:23, it makes a very sharp distinction between the cultures. Here's the distinction as far as it goes. Remember, to be carnal, this is one of the most resounding statements in the Book of Mormon. I think it's the most powerful. If you knew just one thing from the Book of Mormon, this would be the most powerful statement. Nephi 2:23, remember, to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life eternal. Now, carnal isn't just sex, you see. Carnal is everything advertised on TV. It's all carnal. Things like cleansing, hairdo, body exercises, bodybuilding, clothes, cars. All that's carnal, you see, because that's for external appearance, and that's all dedicated to the body appearance. It's all concerned with temporal things, shampoos, foods, curatives, investments, money lines, all those things are junk, you see. Those are the things, those are carnal things. And if you put your mind on them, what's going to happen? They're all going to pass away. They're all rapidly decaying right now. They're going to collapse, and they don't do it slowly. Remember, we're living in an age of extermination, a remarkable time. There have been long times when things have kept on a fairly dead level, and then suddenly there have been these periods of extermination, and they hit rapidly. They pile up rapidly because of the cumulative effect. One thing leads to another, you see. Like when a ship reaches a certain critical place, then it's sure to sinks faster because it sinks faster. And the same way here, that to be carnally minded is death. You're doomed. You're not going anywhere if you put your mind on these things. Well, what else if there's nothing else in the other world? That's what Korihor taught. He says, every man fares in this world according to the management of the creature. There's a word management used in the Book of Mormon. Every man prospers according to his ability, conquers according to his strength, and whatsoever man does is no sin. And why? Because when the man is dead, that is the end thereof. Therefore, they lifted up their heads and rejoiced because they could do anything they wanted and went out to get as rich as they could, as fast as they could. This was what he was teaching. So this is the world we're talking about, and it has a very, very conspicuous place in the Book of Mormon, as you know, this other culture. And they're constantly being brought into conflict. Then we have another culture. As you may think, you notice we oversimplify the Book of Mormon. We say Book of Mormon is the story of the Nephites and Lehites, the good people and the bad people, the white people and the dark people. It wasn't that way at all, as you know. More than half the time, the people of Lehi, of Laman, the Lamanites, were better than the Nephites. And in this chapter, it tells us that they divided up into separate tribes. The, The Lamanites were one group, the Lemuelites were quite another group, and the Nephites. And there were seven tribes. They always kept it that way. Well, that's something. So now we have the third group. What shall we call these? Various ways of designating. We'll call them, they're nomadic or semi-nomadic. They're the people of the steppes. They're the warlords. And you get them in the Book of Mormon. Of course, they're not just the Gadiantans, but you get all sorts of warlords that organize themselves. And, of course, the whole Book of Enoch, Ether, is taken up with them. So we'll call these the warlords. You notice our friend Amalekai here tries to be a warlord. He can't get enough following. And so he has to, well, he does. He goes over, in this chapter, he goes over and makes himself one, the master of the whole thing. So he's a warlord. We'll call him that. Now, they're nomadic and semi-nomadic. Oh, incidentally, on this thing about the world and what the world is, I've written numbers of articles on that. One, a long one that had quite a run among people on the 4th century, the Persian and the Roman empires in the 4th century. It was called the problem of loyalty. They couldn't get anybody to be loyal, you see, to this kind of a society because everybody was out for himself, quite a thing. And then the one on the passing of the church is on that. And describes the world of the 4th century. But I've numbers of other things. Oh, the heliocentric state, things like that. An article in 65 in the Western Political Quarterly called Tending Toll and Taxing. These are the warlords of Asia. See, the whole thing, they're very basic in world history. They're a very sharply marked culture. This is the basis of what's called geopolitics. Excuse me. Geopolitics was conceived by a Scotchman, Halford Mackinder, but it became the favorite doctrine of Hitler's geographer, Haushofer. Haushofer, and they called it geopolitics. And it's the plan on which Hitler, intended to conquer the world. He's going to use this, and it is that there's the heart people. Now, these are these warlords. All the civilizations, you know, are peripheral. Here is what they call the heartland. It's shaped like a shield. It's the area that's covered with snow in winter. That's the great Asiatic heartland, the people of the steppes. They're wanderers. They have always lived a very shaky economy, a marginal economy. If the grass is bad or if they're bad years, you see, then they have to move, and they move on the outside peoples and go to plunder. And on the outside, here you have the civilizations of the Near East, and here you have India, and here you have the Orient, and so forth. These people all built great walls against them. There are the Limes, who ran all clear across Europe for the Romans to keep them out, and so for various. And then there's the White Wall to keep them out of Egypt, especially. There was the White Wall of the Asiatics. At all times, there was pressure on that. And then in India here, you have the Khyber, and Babylon here. It was very important. The pass, of course, they were river people. But and here you have the passes, the Khyber Pass and so forth. And the Chinese went to the trouble of building a wall 1,500 miles long just to keep them out. It's these wild people of the steppes. These are the heart people. See, they're nomads. They are raiders. They're semi-nomadic. Huh? The people of the steppes. They have a very solid culture. They're patriarchal, but they're, of course, they're praetor. They're raiders. Yeah, and this goes back right to the beginning in the story of the Cainites and the Sethians. Very vivid map, isn't it? Remember, we're told Cain became a wanderer on the earth. He went to the land of Nod. Nod means our word Nod means going back and forth. The land of perpetual wandering. Cain was banished, and he became a wanderer. And remember, it says, because of the wickedness. Well, this is what happened, remember? He conspired by a conspiracy to kill his brother and get rich. He wanted the priesthood and all that, and the Lord came and talked with him, told him he was doing what was wrong. We get this all in the Pearl of Great Price, in the Book of Moses there. He refused to listen to the Lord anymore. He stomped on his heel and walked out on him. He went over, and because he and his wife, they loved Satan more than people did in the time of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve could do nothing but mourn before the Lord. And they followed Satan, and he went and took instruction from him and got the degree of Master Mahan, the secret of which, how to get rich by taking life, convert property, life into property. And when he got it, he said, I am master of this great secret that I can murder and get gain. And so by a conspiracy, we're told, Doctrine and Covenants, he murdered his brother Abel. He planned it all out because Satan told him how to do it. He said, swear to me, and so forth. And having done that, he says, now I am free. I got the money I want, and that makes you free. Wealth makes you free, as Mr. Forbes tells us. That's what he says. He said, now I am free. His flocks fall into my hands. So he had them. For that, he became cursed. He could no longer cultivate the earth. The earth refused her strength to him, and he became a wanderer on the face of the earth, and he's doomed to... So it becomes a nomad and a raider, and his descendants of Kshars are Cush and Cain, Cush and Nimrod, and the great hunters and the great conquerors. Yeah, the founders of the first empires, the first cities, as a matter of fact, strangely enough, they're Asiatic. And they become looters. This is geopolitics. A passion for property, for portable wealth that you can carry with you, has to be gold and silver and stuff like that if you're on the move. So this great lust for jewels, the jewel giver, the chief, you know, that's how Beowulf starts out. Skin Skeffing, that was a good king because he gave out rings. You get your followers and you follow them. So you have the great lords of the steps. The book of the ether, which you have left to study, is the classic treatment of this subject. That's what that is, so we don't need to go into it here. They were traders and dealers, being always on the move, you see. And the classic character, the raiders, the robbers, the Gadiantans, and Shiz and Coriantumr in the Book of Mormon. And now we get this would-be raider, Amalickiah. They love splendor and display. They invent the chess game, and life is a chess game where you're always moving around trying to check the king. You see, that's the game you find in the Book of Ether. The chessmate, the king can't be taken. When he's taken, then all his people go over to your side, and that's exactly the way they do it again and again in the Book of Ether, the Jaredites. They're managers and administrators, of course. They work at a distance, patriarchal, tribal. Achish, the daughter of Jared, was a classic example. See, Jared and the daughter of Jared. It goes back to very ancient times. Hath not my Lord read in the books of the ancients which they brought across with them, you see, she says, in John of Jared, how they of old gained power and great kingdoms, and the way they went about it, and this is the method. These people are very real. See, they're very center of things, these raiders. You just look at your National Geographic, you'll find out about them. They like the visible wealth and the display. Cattle raiders, tent people, people of the steppes, gamesters. But you notice there's something noble about them, too. They're chivalric, they're patriarchal, they're adventurous, and they have contempt for the people of the periphery that live in the great stews of Babylon, Mohenjo-Daro, Cairo, places like that. It wasn't Cairo in those days, of course, Memphis. And the city people, with their lush, sensuous, and licentious practices. And, of course, these other people, number one, are sort of out of the picture with them. But then we come to one that are rather closely related to them. We come to the fourth type here. And they are we would call them the nature people. We used to call them primitives, and they call them preliterates. The poor anthropologists have had an awfully hard time, finding some real primitives to study. That's what they're supposed to study, you know, and there aren't any primitives. The primitives are just what's left over from other civilizations. People have gone back to it again. You can't find people that you can definitely prove are primitive or preliterate, anything like that. But you call them nature people because they live according to nature, and that's... As Nephi puts it, we lived after the manner of happiness. We call them the nature people. Now, there are these people in the Book of Mormon that aren't like any of the others, you know. So they live by themselves, they have their own ways and so forth. They're once called primitives or preliterates. They are the survivors. They are the peasant cultures throughout the world. They are the aborigines. They tell us now, if you've been seeing any documentaries on Australia, big run in Australia now, that they've been living with their life unchanged for 40,000 years. And now, with this generation, it all ends. It's interesting, everything comes to an end in this generation. It's a surprising thing. After 40,000 years, it's cut off like that. And but they are our Southwest Indians. They have been living like that. Now here we have Sister Teresa Harvey's house, the first which was ever dated by carbon dating, was Sister Teresa on at Walpi there, found to be 800 years old. And they've been living in that, doing the same things. Sister, she revived the pottery business. The old pottery that was used over 1,000 years ago there. There's a big dump of it right behind their house there. And they're doing the same things, absolutely the same things for 1,000 years. Now that is stability. But they're living on nothing. There's nothing but sand around them. They live on these meshes where they call themselves the Hopi, the peaceful people. They don't make war. And And yet it's the most exciting, most fun place you can imagine. I used to go down there every time I could get a week off or a weekend even. I'd tear down there and celebrate with the Hopis because every weekend they have a grand party, which is a real binge, and they have fun. It's great. And then we read now also about the jungle people who are being driven out by the lumber companies and the cattle companies. The people have been living for thousands and thousands of years, quite satisfactory lives. I mean, very full. It is, and the Eskimos, the same thing. It isn't that they live in unspeakable boredom in which everything is always the same. Not at all. Their world is imaginative. It's colorful, not dull or boring. And they're very hardworking. They have to be to survive on the sand out there. But their stability is marvelous. Of course, they're agriculture. They're the peasantry of the world. At Mickelsburg, when I was on mission in Germany, there's a place, Mickelsburg, where they made the first excavations, where they found the first pottery. That's very old, or very early Neolithic pottery at Mickelsburg. And it was all farming around there in those days, and it still is the same way. Across the river on the other side, they excavated a lot of some villages, and they took the pottery and they scraped the inside of the pots, and they found out what the people ate. And there was soup in there, a mixture of grains and bark and berries and things like that they put in the soup. The very same mixture the people use today. They've never changed that recipe, imagine. And that must be at least 10,000 years. Now, we don't want to get into calendar, things like that. It's an interesting subject. But the same sort of thing here. Naturally, living as they are, they're the most visionary and spiritual of people, highly imaginative, very artistic. All these Indians, Southwest Indians, see, they have their arts of weaving and pottery, and when they put on their dances, they are magnificent. Everything has to be properly done. There can be nothing old, nothing dirty, nothing boughten. It all has to be fresh, and all has to be from the earth. It's quite a marvelous thing. We're forcing them to change now. I hope we aren't as badly as I heard last. But notice there's a tremendous hostility between us and them. Oh, I could read you some... I may read you some court records now and things that have come out, if I can find them.